He said, let's not call marriage biblical. Let's just call it healthy. Can you see, friend, why we have a crisis in the church in America? We've lost our way. We virtually abandoned the truth. Now, I want you to urge you to get a copy of my book, Renewing the Soul of America, one person at a time, beginning with you. In that book, there is a chapter entitled The Lighthouse. And it talks about exactly what we can do, what we have to do to restore the light in America's lighthouse. It's endorsed by 38 national Christian leaders. I want to urge you to get a copy. It's a $17 book. Your gift of just $12 or more to Save America Ministries this holiday weekend is going to put it in your hands. Call us, 1-800-SAVE-USA. That's 1-800-SAVE-USA. Write to us at Save America Ministries. Get it on our website, Renewing the Soul of America. Our website, saveus.org. Now, I want to urge you to become a partner with us. Day after day, we're preparing the way of the Lord for history's final hour. Daring to tell the truth, send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Let's live in preach righteousness.
You've been listening to Viewpoint with Chuck Crismier. Viewpoint is supported by the faithful gifts of our listeners. Let me urge you to become a partner with Chuck as a voice to the church declaring vision for the nation. Join us again next time on Viewpoint as we confront the issues of America's heart and home.
The views expressed on this program are those of the hosts and guests and are not necessarily those of IR and its advertisers or affiliates.
This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. I have to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, of course, for the next hour, I hope they're going to be the views of Peter Hammond. Under any circumstances, why, Peter is a missionary from South Africa, born and raised in Rhodesia, and the situation was, of course, that we have a very, very serious problem in Rhodesia today, and of course it's a direct result of America's interference in the policies of Africa. And I really need to point out the fact that, Rhodesia was a prosperous nation. There was no organized discrimination in South Africa, and the black and white got along well together. Certainly, South Africa was the breadbasket of much of Africa, having tremendous amounts of food to export. And then, of course, along comes the American State Department in its idealism and insists that the Rhodesians put into power a man named Mugabe, who was a known communist. He was been trained in Red China. Well, the Rhodesian people didn't want that. They actually wanted to elect, and they did elect a man named Bishop Mezaweo, a black minister, moderate. But that didn't serve the purposes of the American State Department or our program. And so they insisted, of course, Rhodesia reverse its vote and bring to power Mugabe. And, of course, eventually the Rhodesians, under tremendous international pressure, did bring Mugabe to power, and that was in 1980. It's been all downhill since that time. And to tell us what's really going on in Rhodesia today, Peter Hammond from Frontline Fellowship. Hi, Peter. How are you doing tonight?
Dr. Stan, good evening.
You go right ahead and tell our listeners about Rhodesia, what happened in Rhodesia, and what's going on there today.
Well, Dr. Stan, it's a real tragedy. It's a crisis. And yet there's an opportunity as the people are rising up in absolute outrage and indignation against this tyrant Mugabe, that there's still hope that we can get rid of this man. But it's 28 years of looting and devastation. And Rhodesia, which was one of the most efficiently run, magnificent countries in Africa, has been turned into an absolute hellhole, which is Zimbabwe today. Zimbabwe today, we are now having Mugabe, who's just lost the elections despite all of his intrigues and all of his treachery and cooking the books, and there was an enormous amount of rigging, and yet still they couldn't suppress the overwhelming rejection of the Marxist dictator Robert Mugabe by the electorate. And although he was voted out of office on the 19th of March, he's still there, and he is waging a war against his own people with Red Chinese weapons. Red China has sent shipments of millions of rounds of arms and thousands of rocket launchers and mortars, and he is using these against his own people right now. Thousands and thousands of people's homes have been destroyed, and churches have been bulldozed and burned. Pastors are being tortured. It's not possible to exaggerate what's going on there. It's a war against the people of Zimbabwe by this Marxist thug Mugabe, who was put there, of course, by the United Nations and the U.S. State Department policy back in 1980.
And, of course, my understanding is that they're actually burning many of their political opponents alive, burning down their homes.
Yes, indeed.
Tens of thousands of homes have been burned.
That's right. It's a literal war against them. And we've got the documentation and the pictures and photos. They literally are burning people alive in the streets. And it's war against the people who dared to vote against the leader of the country.
And because these are black people predominantly. They're the black people who want to be free. They will never be free, thanks to the American State Department and our policies and Henry Kissinger, who promised the Rhodesian people if things ever got out of hand, America would be there to help them. Well, Peter, you go ahead and pick the story up there.
Yes, indeed. You know, Dr. Stanley, the situation in Zimbabwe is this. We had in the old Rhodesia an incredibly strong economy. In fact, the Rhodesian dollar back in the mid-70s was three times stronger than the American dollar. You needed three American dollars to buy one Rhodesian dollar. Today, it is absolutely beyond bizarre. A billion Zimbabwe dollars is not worth one American dollar today, a billion. In fact, when I was up there 2 months ago, a loaf of bread cost $25 million for one loaf of bread in Zimbabwe. Inflation's 500,000%. Employment is 85%. Unemployment, 85%. Officially, it's probably worse. They've destroyed almost every business. There's electricity power outs, blackouts, as long as 28 days in duration in the capital city of Harare. I mean, imagine a modern city with no electricity for 28 days. Not a power failure, just no power whatsoever for days and weeks on end. And you can imagine the plumbing has broken down, no plumbing available in many of the places most of the time. Hospitals broken down, electricity, telephones. You can think of everything necessary for sustaining civilization has been eroded and broken down. We, in our mission, are forced to be smuggling in medicines and food and medicines for diabetes patients and pensioners who would die otherwise because they can't get in the shops, they can't get in the hospitals, the postal service is broken down. I mean, can you imagine such breakdown in a country that used to be a shining light to all of Africa? I should remind listeners that back in in the 1950s, Rhodesia was leading Africa with hydroelectric power, with the Kariba Dam, and showing the way forward for Africa. And if we utilized the hydroelectric power capacity of Africa, we could provide enough electricity for all of Africa from just the one river, the Congo, alone. So you can imagine the potential of Africa. We've got most of the great minerals, most of the gold, most of the diamonds, most of the coal, most of everything you can think, from platinum to cobalt. Africa is the richest piece of real estate in terms of minerals and wildlife. We've got animals that you can't get in any other continent in the world, from cheetahs through to rhinos and hippos and giraffes. Magnificent animals. And Rhodesia, the best game reserves, Wanky, for example, and real wildlife sanctuaries, which have now been destroyed. Rhodesian agriculture was again, some of the best in Africa, and those farms have been destroyed because they had white farmers, white commercial farmers, and 5,500 commercial farms have been looted and destroyed and pillaged, and the country is now starving. But Mugabe reckons that a few million people starving is a small price to pay.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, Peter is simply pointing out that in Harare, which was really a very, very modern city, just like probably the one that most of our listeners live in, and our wife, Chris Harare, of course, has no electricity. What, 25 or 28 days without electricity? Certainly the postal system is broken down, the telephone system is broken down, the healthcare system is broken down, the shelves are empty, and in the stores there's little or no food, there's no medicines. Peter and his ministry have to smuggle. They have to smuggle insulin and treatment in medicines in for the diabetics, or they would die. And, of course, it all has to be done illegally because, of course, the government refuses to allow medicine to be brought in or even food to be brought in for the starving people. Of a nation of 11 million people, 5 million already fled into adjacent countries. You're not hearing about this great human tragedy here in America while we're concerned about Britney Spears, about Paris Hilton, about the NBA playoffs and Tony Bryant and all the really important things, and we could be not totally unconcerned about the terrible suffering that is taking place in Zimbabwe today as a direct result of American foreign policy and interference. Now, who is it who is actually subsidizing Mugabe's corrupt government today?
Red China. The weapons are coming from Red China. There's no doubt China is looking at recolonizing as being the new colonists in Africa. We're seeing Chinese businessmen, military advisors all over Africa. I mean, as far as West Africa, it's absolutely extraordinary how many are there. They're in South Africa and in Zimbabwe. Many of the white farms, which have been pillaged and looted, and these African-born white farmers who spoke Shona or Ndebele and were fully into the culture, they've now been replaced with Chinese people who don't even speak English, let alone Shona. And so it's an extraordinary situation. In the Zimbabwe University, there's only one university in Zimbabwe, in Harare. You have to study Chinese if you're going to be at university. It's a compulsory subject at university. Have you ever heard of a university that has a compulsory subject of any sort, let alone Chinese? But that just shows you how China is the number one player in Zimbabwe right now.
But my understanding is that Great Britain is still funneling money to keep Mugabe in power, that the United States is sending money over there to fight AIDS, which of course gets into the coffers of Mugabe. America is sending money over agriculture, teaching people agriculture, and of course that has to go through Mugabe. And the United Nations is sending in a great deal, of course, food, but that all goes to Mugabe's people, not to the starving masses.
That is correct, and this is such an important point, Dr. Stan. I really hope that all of our listeners tonight understand this, and that is that relief aid to Africa has not been getting to the people on the ground. There's an enormous amount of wastage, enormous amount of corruption, but the problem is aid that comes in from the World Food Program or from any of the UN or NGOs connected to them or from USAID or from the European Union, it doesn't go to the people, it goes to the governments in Africa, the very ones who are causing the famines and the human rights abuse and the disasters, the atrocities and the massacres. They're the ones getting it. So that we can literally say that if it wasn't for the relief aid from the West, these tyrants in Africa would have collapsed long ago. They've been propped up by aid from the outside, which doesn't get to the people they are meant to get to, the people on the ground, the governments that have poisoned the wells, that have looted the crops and the livestock and have destroyed everything. The scorched earth socialists who destroying the economies, they're the ones being entrusted with the food aid by the European Union and the United States, and it's just bizarre. We would say this, that if people want to help us in Africa, the best thing they can do is not give any aid to the UN or to any of these corrupt governments in Africa, and then we may have a chance to get rid of the tyrants that oppress us.
And of course, what the United States should do is say to communist China, you get your troops out of Rhodesia and you stop funding this ruthless, tyrannical dictator, or we're not going to come to the Olympics. But do you think our leaders would do that? Oh, no. We would keep the South Africans from participating in the Olympics, you know, because they had apartheid and there was discrimination, although it was improving in South Africa. But we wouldn't let them come to the Olympics. But America's got to go over there and pay homage to these ruthless, tyrannical society and communist China that has one of the worst civil rights records in the entire world, who actually, during the process between 1958 and 1962, starved to death between 30 million and, 44 million of their own people. We never even talk about that in this country, totally blacked out by the controlled media. You can look it up on the Internet under the Great Hunger. That's the Great Hunger. Just Google in the Great Hunger. You'll read about the story. Never mentioned by the controlled media in America. And America is supporting communist China that is actually maintaining this ruthless tyranny in Rhodesia, which, of course, is starving the people there and supporting a regime that is beating and burning and raping and torturing anybody who dares to vote against the administration. And now they're going to insist on another vote, and you can be sure that this time they'll do a better job of fixing the election, the polls.
Well, indeed, and of course they're bludgeoning and tyrannizing the people. And you can imagine many of the people who had the courage, you know, and what courage it must have been to have in this police state dared to vote against the government. And many of them have fled, and some of them are dead, and many will not dare to come out again. And also, when they can see how Mugabe has gotten away with this for the last few months, that he's still in power after being voted out of office, how disillusioned they will be, how many will dare to try and come into the country and vote on this next occasion. So if Mugabe is allowed to get away with this, it just shows that democracy in Africa is a farce, and the Organization of African Unity is an absolute disgrace and a farce, and the United Nations Security Council is a complete bunch of hypocrites, because we pick on those who they perceive as enemies of the communists, but they never deal with real human rights abuses and tyrants. I think the United Nations should be exposed for what it is. The UN is the biggest collection of unelected mass murderers in the world. Most of the leaders in the UN and the governments represented there have no mandate from their own citizens. They've not been voted into power there. So basically, what is the UN except a collection of unelected mass-murdering dictators?
Well, what is Desmond Tutu in South Africa doing about Rhodesia? Has he had the courage to speak out against, of course, this Marxist thug who's ruling Rhodesia?
Well, we remember that Desmond Tutu back in 1980 said the kingdom of God has arrived in Zimbabwe. And he praised Robert Mugabe as a wonderful liberator of his people. And even Desmond Tutu, who today still wants to say Mugabe's a liberator, not that anyone in Zimbabwe thinks that, but he is saying in interviews that he's very embarrassed and ashamed of what the black liberators are doing to the people, and that the liberators of yesterday can be the tyrants of today. And you know, it's interesting that even Tutu's had to admit that, but of course they never were liberators. If a person like Mugabe came to power through terrorism and deception, he's going to stay in power through terrorism and deception. So I don't know why the Tutus of this world are so surprised.
Well, of course, now, what about the leaders of South Africa? Certainly Mbeki is, and I think he's still the president there, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Thabo Mbeki is still the president, and he is very unpopular in our country, and the people are astounded and disgusted that he is pictured so often hugging and kissing Mugabe and walking hand in hand with them like they lovers. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable and disgraceful how Thabo Mbeki, who is meant to be promoting this NEPAD, this whole African Renaissance and peer review, and he's meant to be the one who's representing the Commonwealth in resolving the Zimbabwe crisis, And the MDC, the Movement for Democratic Change, the opposition in Zimbabwe, who's actually the proper elected government at this stage, even though they have been kept out of power by the state police and army of Mugabe, they have now said they no longer trust or want to work with Mbeki because Mbeki is too much of a communist and he's too much friends with Mugabe, and they can't see him being an honest broker. So Thabo Mbeki has been repudiated by most of the population of South Africa and disgust at what he's done in supporting this tyrant in Zimbabwe.
Well, my understanding is what there are well over 4 million people from Zimbabwe, Rhodesians, blacks, who have actually fled into South Africa because, of course, of hunger. They had no opportunity. They were starving to death. And now, of course, they're being attacked by gangs in South Africa. What's that all about?
Yes, this has been absolutely horrific. If anyone's been looking at the pictures of this, there are people being burned alive in South Africa now in the streets, in the open, in front of the cameras. It's called necklacing. When the thugs pour gasoline over the people and set them alight. This is exactly what the ANC terrorists of Mugabe, of Mandela, did to gain power in South Africa back in the 1980s and early 90s. And now we're seeing it again in South Africa. And what it is now is this is violence being targeted by black South Africans against the black Zimbabweans, who are refugees who fled to South Africa sanctuary to escape from Mugabe. And apparently the complaints of the South African Khoza and other nations who are rising up against the Zimbabwean blacks, who are mostly Matabele or Shona, is they're saying, you are coming and taking our jobs and our women. And in fact, of course, for survival, many millions of Zimbabweans have fled across the border to South Africa. And they work harder, they've got a better work ethic, and it's not surprising that most people I know prefer to hire Zimbabweans because they work better and they work more diligently, and they have a better ethic, so they don't tend to steal on a job. So many businesses that I know prefer to hire Zimbabweans. And so what's happened now is an absolute outpouring of violence, burning out whole suburbs of Zimbabwean refugees from their shacks and their squatter camps by South African blacks. Resurgence of this necklace murder.
And of course, here in America, we're concerned about Britney Spears, about Paris Hilton, about the NBA. There's plenty of information like this in the international press. There's plenty of footage they could show on television, but we wouldn't want to, of course, jar the American people out of their pleasant repose, you know, as they simply sleep. Well, of course, these terrible things are going on in the world, and, well, if we're unconcerned about what's going on in other countries, will anybody be concerned when similar things happen in America? Remember, men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. Well, Peter, what about the situation there in South Africa? My understanding was it's about 40% unemployment?
Yes, sir, indeed. The unemployment is horrific, and we have to understand that this is the result of affirmative action in South Africa and the racism of the ANC government. You know, according to the myth, the once upon a time and they all lived happily ever after, racism in South Africa ended in 1994, but of course that's not true. Nelson Mandela didn't end apartheid. Apartheid had been ended already by P.W. Botha many years before. There was no apartheid legislation for Mandela to abolish at all by the time he came to power. He, in fact, brought racism back by bringing back affirmative action, race classification for affirmative action and job quotas and reservations for certain jobs based on race. And this has caused a lot of problems in South Africa, including the electricity power failures that are now normal and common because we don't seem to have enough real engineers who do the job with ethics. And the brain drain's been huge. We've lost millions of white South Africans. Some of the most qualified have left the country. And many black South Africans who qualified have also left because they're unhappy with the crime and heavy taxation and many of the things that are tolerated in our land. And so South Africa's actually been going down, down, down in many ways, and the unemployment is because every one of these top people who leave the country are employers. So the people who were creating the jobs and employing people leaving means that you're having more and more unemployment. Every single year since the ANC came to power, we've got another 1 million people unemployed net. So unemployment in our country has been increasing dramatically since the ANC came to power. Because let's face it, socialist policies never create employment.
And, of course, I think it's really amazing to think about the fact that in South Africa, where I lived, of course, during the mid-1970s for 3 years in a wonderful society, but, you know, suddenly there was never any question about shortage of electricity. There was never any feeling of lawlessness. I, suddenly working as a senior physician at a black hospital and had a whole department of orthopedics with about 80 patients under me, I never felt any animosity upon the blacks towards me personally, and we walked very freely down the part of the city where they lived, and certainly there was a good feeling between black and white there. But I understand now, of course, the government wants to collect the guns from the people. And I thought that was so interesting. We talked to Larry Pratt. I don't know if you know Larry, but...
Oh, yes, very good friend.
Gunners of America, who said there was the black, gun owners who went to the whites and said, join us, do not turn in your guns. I mean, this is our only protection against tyranny. Would you like to explore that idea a little bit?
Indeed. Dr. Stan, when governments outlaw guns, and only the outlaws have guns, and if a government fears weapons in the hands of its citizens, then the citizens should not trust that government with power. No government should have a monopoly of power and force. And the best safeguard against tyranny is an armed citizenry. So there's no doubt whatsoever that every genocide in the 20th century was preceded by gun control. Whether you're talking about the Turks massacring 1.5 million Armenians in 1915, or whether you're talking about Stalin's massacres of millions in Russia, or Mao Zedong in China, or Pol Pot in Cambodia, whichever massacre or genocide you want to refer to all the way through to Rwanda, all of it was preceded by disarming of the population. Because if you've got weapons on both sides, you have a war. But if you've got weapons only on one side, then you can have a massacre. And the Marxists prefer disarmed victims. Just like a criminal prefers an unarmed victim.
Hold that thought, we'll be back in just a moment here.
Disarmed.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and certainly Peter is talking about what's going on in South Africa where he lives, and of course they have their power outages, and certainly very, very frequently the power outages come. Never used to be like that, but it is now that the United States has liberated South Africa and brought the communists to power, and contrary to everything the American people have been told by the controlled media, Nelson Mandela was a lifelong communist, as is Mabeki, who succeeded him, and the whole society is beginning to implode, 40% unemployment, electricity blackouts, of course, industry is leaving the country, much of it never came back after country was transferred from white to black control. Certainly the healthcare system is breaking down, and one of the things that the government wants to do now is disarm the population. And Peter was just pointing out that the blacks actually, Gun Owners Association, went to the White Gun Owners Association and said, don't turn in your guns. And, of course, Peter primly points out that the reason governments want to have gun registration and gun confiscation is that they want to be able to massacre the population. And, of course, if both the people and the government are armed, why, you can have a war. But if you have simply only the government armed, then you can have a massacre and genocide. And that is exactly what's planned in South Africa. And fortunately, the Black Gun Owners Association is working with the White Gun Owners Association, and hopefully they will never turn in their weapons. Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, indeed. You know, Dr. Stan, if people listening to us have seen the film Hotel Rwanda, or the more recent and even more accurate one, Shooting Dogs, on the Rwandan genocide, they'll recognize that massacres like that could never take place in an area where you've got generally armed population. It can only take place where you've got a disarmed population. And the Rwandan Holocaust should warn us, because, you know, in just 6 weeks, 800,000 people were slaughtered with machetes. That's more people were killed with machetes in 6 weeks in Rwanda in 1994 than died from atomic weapons in all of history. And people keep talking about the danger of atomic weapons. Well, the dangers of gun control is very clear to someone like me. I've been working 26 years as a missionary to the persecuted church, and I've ministered as far afield as Poland and Albania and Romania and Eastern Europe and all across Africa, Congo, Mozambique and Angola, Nigeria and Sudan. And I've seen a common pattern, and that is that Marxist governments love to disarm their citizens. They don't trust their weapons with weapons They don't trust the citizens with weapons. They want a monopoly of power. And so the citizens can't trust that government with power. And I think it's extremely dangerous when you have any politicians talking about disarming the law-abiding citizens. Surely they should have crime control, not gun control.
Amen to that. And I think it's really, of course, a great tragedy. When I lived in South Africa, it was a wonderful society. There at the Black Hospital where I worked, we had a cardiac unit that was doing open heart surgery at the time. This was in the mid-70s. Why today, of course, the whole society is imploding. There's not enough money. They're cutting back on health care for the blacks. And, of course, both black and white are far worse off than before the United States State Department and Henry Kissinger and his friends and Jimmy Carter, of course, destroyed this society that was moving rapidly towards equality between black and white and brought the communists to power. You know, the difficulty is, Peter, here in the United States, most people don't understand that the American State Department brought a communist to power in Rhodesia, brought a communist power in South Africa, brought the communist to power in Southwest Africa, brought the communist to power in Angola. It's so difficult for the average American to believe that.
Yes, I'm sure it is, but, you know, over the last 26 years that I've been serving as a missionary to the persecuted in Africa, I couldn't help but notice how frequently the mass media, the secular media, has chosen to target those who are targeted by international communism. You know, is it just coincidental that during the Rhodesian Bush War, the media chose to confuse the issues, avoid the heart of the matter, vilify the victims, and whitewash the villains? They did that in the border war in Southwest Africa, Namibia, during the riots in South Africa, in the killing fields of Mozambique, in the civil war in Angola, in the massacre of Matabele tribes in Zimbabwe, in the Red Terror in Ethiopia, in the Holocaust in Rwanda, the jihad in Sudan, the wave of church burning in northern Nigeria, any of the many calamities and conflicts in Africa that I have personally witnessed and documented, I found that the mass media chooses to confuse the issues or ignore it and vilify the victims, the Christians, and whitewash the villains, the Marxists.
And I think this is so vitally important that our listeners really understand how the game is played. It's nothing as it appears to be. There's very little, you know, relationship between what you believe, your perception, and reality, because, of course, you know, what you believe is being carefully controlled by those who control the mass media, who have a different agenda. Their goal, a one-world order, a one-world religion with the destruction of Christianity, and I believe the coming world leader. And all you need to do is, of course, look back and see what's gone on and study history. History is a wonderful teacher of what the future holds for each and every one of us. Well, Dr. Stan and Peter, simply from man's point of view, I'm not talking about from God's point of view, but from man's point of view, do you think there's any way that that South Africa could be turned around without a mass revival and certainly the people turning to God and just rising up and overthrowing this Marxist government that the American State Department installed?
Well, indeed, we have absolutely no trust in princes or in governments, and definitely none in the United Nations. But yes, our only hope is in God. Our only hope is a spiritual revival. I believe the only hope for Africa is to turn in repentance and restitution to God, who we have so horribly violated all of his laws and offended his holiness, and to think that we have rather believed the mass media than believed God's word. We've rather trusted in governments than trusted in Almighty God, our Creator and Eternal Judge. So, yes, I see our only hope to come back to the Lord, and there is a spiritual hunger in South Africa. You yourself have seen it. There are many people on the ground who are genuine, dedicated Christians. Now, we know that governments and the UN and the State Department don't seem to care what the Christians think, but there's a God in heaven who we are turning to in prayer, and we've seen the Lord intervene. I mean, I remember the time when the people were pleading with God to intervene in Mozambique, and Samora Machel was burning the villages and persecuting the Christians, and sending men to concentration camps. It was a horrible time in Marxist Mozambique during the Red Terror. But God answered the prayers, and Samora Machel, the dictator of Mozambique, he crashed and died in this plane crash in his Tupolev Russian aircraft in 1986, and you'd remember it while many Christians were praying for an end to the persecution of Mozambique. And it was just one of many examples when we've seen God intervene. In 1989, in Romania, when the dictatorship of Nicolae Ceausescu was butchering the people and massacring the people in the town squares, and God intervened. And on Christmas Day 1989, there, Dracula, as the people called him, Ceausescu, the communist dictator, was shot by his own army, and the people, for the first time in 40 years, could celebrate Christmas openly and freely. Now, I've seen God answer prayers, imprecatory prayers, prayers for justice, praying the Psalms, and change history. We cannot trust in man-made governments, but we can put our faith in the Lord. And I'd advise our listeners to do what many Christians in Zimbabwe are doing right now. Turn to the Psalms, the middle book of the Bible, the biggest book in the Bible, the prayer book of the Bible, and pray these Psalms for justice. Pray for God to intervene and to judge the wicked and to intervene and transform this. The Zimbabwean Christians have tremendous courage. They've gone through a lot, and they're going through absolute torment and tribulation now, and we should stand with them in prayer.
Hold that thought, Peter. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, Peter's saying that really the hope for Africa is revival and the prayers of the people there, and he's actually seen examples of God's intervention, whether it would be in Mozambique or in Romania, where, of course, God intervened and destroyed the wicked rulers, the wicked tyrants there, and of course, the real hope, certainly for our country here in the United States, is revival. The trouble is, we're not going to have it without God's people's prayer and of course without our leaders having the courage to do what's right and to have more fear of God than they do of government. Well, before we go on, Peter, I'd like you to get out your website. I'd like you to tell people how they can get in touch with your ministry, and I want to let our listeners know that we support Peter Hammond. We have for some time. We think it's wonderful what he's doing. We wish we could be over there with him, but God's putting me behind the microphone. At least we give Peter a voice here when he comes to the United States. How can people get in touch with you, and if they want to, perhaps even support what you're doing?
Well, thank you, Dr. Stan. We are trying to put as much as possible on the website. If you turn to www.frontline.org.za, so it's frontline, one word, frontline.org.za. You can email our office in the States as well, info@frontlinefellowship.net, info@frontlinefellowship.net, or check the website out, www.frontline.org.za. We try to put a lot of ammunition that you can use against our mutual enemies, the United Nations, the Marxists, the Communists, and of course the Islamic Jihadists as well, because that's where we're working in Africa, and if we know our common enemy, a victory over them here or on that side is a victory for both of us.
And of course, Peter's written a number of books. One is, I know I remember very vividly, on Rhodesia. There's other books on certainly the Islamic threat in Africa. And tell me, what's happening as far as Islam? Because the great deal of the radical Islamic movement is being funded by our good friends in Saudi Arabia, who are the major funders and financiers of the Islamic jihadist movement throughout the world. And of course, as you remember, the Saudi leadership is very close friends with them. With the Bush family, but be that as it may, what about the influence of Islam in Africa? Certainly, many of the radicals are trying to kill off the Christians, but is the Lord moving within the Muslims there and bringing men to know our personal relationship with our Lord?
Well, that is true. Muslims are coming to Christ in Africa, but I should say some of the bad news first. I mean, I've been bombed in churches. I've come under aerial and artillery bombardments and rocket bombardments while preaching in churches in Sudan. The Sudan government has bombed churches, hospitals. Our mission base in Sudan was bombed 10 times in just over a year. There's tremendous attacks on Christians. In northern Nigeria, I just heard from one of our workers up there that their church has been destroyed by the order of the Muslim government under Sharia law in northern Nigeria. So the hostility of Islam for Christianity is absolutely intense, and yet Muslims are coming to Christ. A leading Saudi Arabian Muslim leader, Sheikh Hamad al-Qahtani, he is a top leader in Saudi Arabia. He has reported on Al Jazeera television that every day 16,000 Muslims convert to Christianity, and he claimed that Islam was losing 6 million Christians a year. 6 million Muslims are being lost a year to becoming Christians. And this he called a tragedy. Now, even allowing for the fact that the Sheikh could be inflating the numbers to incite Islamic reaction against Christianity. We do know that many people are coming to Christ. In fact, some reports claim that as many as 5 million Muslims have turned to Christ in Sudan in the last 20 years. 5 million. And in Algeria, we know that 13 Protestant churches, including one that's with 1,200 members, was closed down by the Algerian government. Many missionaries expelled, many Christians imprisoned. The Moroccan Muslim newspapers are openly complaining that up to 40,000 Muslims have turned to Christianity in Morocco just in the last few years. And I could go through many other countries. There's so many exciting stories that indicate that there are people coming to Christ in the Muslim world. And I think this is one reason why you see the Muslims fighting back so viciously against the Christians, is because they're trying to stem the tide of people who are defecting, who are leaving them. And so even though we hear a lot of bad news in the press, which is true and is even worse than is being reported, but there's still God's good news behind the news, which I think we need to realize that in the midst of it, God is still pulling people to him. There's still that 7,000 who haven't bowed the knee to Baal.
Happening in the Sudan today, certainly in southern Sudan, there was a large Christian component. They've killed about 2 million of them. A lot of them, of course, some of them had killed because, of course, the Chinese communists were funding the Sudanese government. Of course, the Chinese communists there working for China Petrol were able to raise their money right here in the United States, of course, with the help of Warren Buffett, with the help of British Petroleum, who put up somewhere between $3 and $5 billion so that China Petrol could go into Sudan, drill for oil, and then, of course, with the proceeds, pay off the Sudanese government, was then bought sophisticated weapons and went into the south to kill the Christians. So we can thank, of course, the American Securities and Exchange Commission for allowing a communist government agency, China Petrol, to raise $3 to $5 billion here on American markets. And we can thank certain Warren Buffett too, because of course he bears responsibility for what he does with Berkshire Hathaway's money. But pick the story up there.
Yes, you know, I've had the joy, Dr. Stan, of going into Sudan many times in the last 14 years, and I must have done about 27 missions to Sudan, some for up to a month at a time, over the last few years, and smuggled about 300,000 Bibles in there, established some schools and hospitals, and it's been a wonderful work to see the growth of the church. But during the time, every single church I've ministered in has been bombed, sometimes frequently, by the Sudan Air Force. In one church I've ministered in Kauda, they endured 18 aerial bombardments from the Sudan Air Force within a 12-month period. And in just one bombing, 19 school children and two adults at this school, the church school, were killed by the Sudan government. Now, this is just one example. I could tell you about this man in Nigeria, up in Sudan, who's had his feet axed off at the ankles. Here he is, a pastor. No feet. Because he is an evangelist, and they're trying to stop him from taking the gospel to his neighbors. So they axed his feet off at the ankles. Now the Bible says how beautiful on the mountains are the feet of him who brings good news. Now, this brother doesn't have any feet, but he still is taking the good news to his neighbors. And he's not going to let the inconvenience of not having feet keep him. He's walking on his knees or riding on his donkey. And I've got a picture of him, and you've probably seen that picture. And this other brother who's got his arm cut off by the Arabs, and so many stories we could tell of these courageous people who, despite the wickedness of the United Nations and of the Red Chinese government and of these jihadists in power in Khartoum, they're continuing to stand firm for Christ. And to me, it's an inspiration. We must fear God. We must be like those three friends of Daniel who could say to Nebuchadnezzar, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us, and he will. But even if he doesn't, we still won't bow before your gods, nor will we serve your idols. And I think that's got to be our mentality. We need to have backbone.
Well, now, of course, what's happening in the southern part of the Sudan? As the hostilities continue, I understood there was a peace agreement for a time. Is it holding at all?
There is a very unstable, volatile peace in southern Sudan at the moment. We do notice in this last year, according to the ceasefire agreement, the government of Sudan was meant to have withdrawn all their troops from southern Sudan by mid last year, and they missed that deadline. They missed the next deadline. So there's still Arab troops in the south, which is in breach of the peace agreement. So there's a lot of suspicion that they are preparing for another offensive soon and that they've just been using this time as an opportunity to rearm and reorganize. So, yes, there's peace in Sudan, but we don't know for how long.
Well, what about the western part of the Sudan over there in Darfur? Here we hear, in the United States, we hear a lot of information, you know, about, of course, about 200,000 people, you know, who are refugees, and about, of course, this is an instance of Muslim killing Muslim, the Arab Muslims killing the black Muslims, riding in on their camelback and slaughtering and raping and destroying. So are the figures, of course, of carnage there in Darfur being exaggerated by the media to distract our attention from the other parts of Africa where really serious persecution of Christians is taking place? What's happening in Darfur?
I believe that's exactly what's happening. There is an exaggeration on Darfur and there's an ignoring of the far greater and much longer tragedy of the Islamic Jihad against the Christians in southern Sudan and the Lubmans. It's absolutely extraordinary. Approximately 2 million people, most of them Christians, have died in the 50 years jihad against the Christians in southern Sudan. But the news media showed little interest, and the UN and Western governments did very little for the Christian victims of jihad in southern Sudan. However, for some reason, the 5 or 6 years of low-intensity conflict in western Sudan, in Darfur, has received enormous worldwide media government attention. And as a result, it's also received a huge amount of Christian aid and attention, disproportionately great. But the fact is Darfur is 99% Muslim. It's a Muslim area in Western Sudan. What's going on in Sudan now is typical Muslim-on-Muslim violence. It's typical Arab banditry that's been going on for centuries. In this case, Muslim Arabs are fighting Muslim blacks. But the Christians that we serve in southern Sudan, in northern Nigeria, and other parts of Africa, they're very cynical about this, and they point out something that's interesting. They say it seems the West is only concerned for Muslims and never Christians. Now, this is an interesting point. Note this. They've said to me, the West showed tremendous concern for Muslims in Bosnia, Muslims in Kuwait, Muslims in Somalia, Muslims in Afghanistan and Iraq, Muslims in Darfur. But the West stands by while hundreds of thousands of Christians are slaughtered in Rwanda and in southern Sudan and the Nuba Mountains. And the point that these Africans have made to me is it seems the world media and the UN and the US State Department only mobilize international campaigns to support Muslim victims, never Christians. Now, I think that's significant. But there's another point that the black Christians have pointed out to us that the black Muslims of Darfur have traditionally been some of the worst slave raiders, guilty of many of the worst atrocities committed against Christians in Bahr el-Ghazal. And so what you're seeing at the moment in Darfur is the slave raiders who caused most of the atrocities in the Nuba Mountains and Bahr el-Ghazal. They're the ones who now are basically reaping what they've sowed. So it's extraordinary that so much of the world's attention and aid is going to people who've committed horrible atrocities themselves against the Christians, but next to no concern has been given for the Christian victims. Now, why is that?
Well, we could spend a full hour talking about that, but I think asking the question, hopefully we'll start to get the Christians of this country beginning to question what the foreign policy of the United States really is. Tell us a little bit about the Congo. I understand that up to 4 million people have been slaughtered there.
Yes, indeed. In fact, Dr. Stan, that's probably a conservative estimate. 4 million people died in the last 10 years. Since 1998, to this point, about 4 million have been killed. Now, at this moment, there's a bit of an uneasy, shaky, almost kind of peace. At this moment, there's not open warfare, although there's a lot of simmering lawlessness. But there's no political freedom in Congo. However, there is a window of opportunity. We are finding a surprising amount of opportunity for ministry in the Congo right now. So in this communist chaos, 48 years of communist chaos in the Congo, we are seeing an openness, and I have been in the Congo recently and had up to several thousand people at a single service and over 1,000 people at a biblical worldview seminar for several days. My deputy director, Charles van Wyk, is in the Congo right now, and if listeners could pray for him, he's doing ministry there. We've got wonderful opportunities across the whole of the Congo River, which is a massive river system. 18 million people living on or close to the river that can only be reached from the river. So we're starting a river ministry there too. So the Congo, there's been a lot of trouble there, and the people there point out to us that when the Belgians were there, everything was efficient and neat and clean, and the roads worked well, and nobody starved, and how well things were run then, and what a paradise, and what a rich country, and how much optimism there was for the future, and you could provide enough electricity for the entire continent of Africa just on the Congo River from hydroelectric power. And then, in 1960, the communist dictator, Patrice Lumumba, was given power, and he started having people massacred so that the Christians in the Katanga province, which is where we do most of our work now, seceded from the chaos, and they said, Moise Tshombe at the time said, we are seceding from chaos. And the United Nations came in and invaded not the Congo, but Katanga. And they forced the Christians of Katanga, the pro-Western Christians of Katanga, of Moise Tshombe, to rejoin the communist chaos of the Congo. And, you know, if anyone doubts the malice of the UN, they need to read the book The Fearful Master, or see the film The Katanga Story, because that documents very well what happened then. I've been dealing with the people ministering in Katanga, and the people remember the fact that the UN came and bombed their hospitals and schools and churches and absolutely betrayed them in the worst way and forced this stable pro-Western country of Katanga to rejoin the communist chaos of the massacres and how many million people have died in the Congo because of the wickedness that was perpetrated by the UN back in the early 60s.
Yes, Fearful Master, you could probably get up on Amazon. It was written by our good friend Ed Griffin, and of course we have still have the book of the 46 Angry Men. I don't know how many of them we have. We've never offered it, but it was written by the doctors there in Katanga, who saw the atrocities by the United Nations troops. Of course, we're never mentioned here in the United States because, after all, the United Nations is the hope of the world, or is it?
Well, of course, and you would remember, Dr. Stan, that the U.S. Air Force provided the C-130 transports for the UN troops to get to the Congo.
Right. And, of course, what we wanted, of course, was to prevent a Christian nation from developing there, an orderly Christian nation, to plunge them into the chaos of the Congo. And today the roads are all gone. Certainly there is no organized society. Everything is chaotic, and the healthcare system has broken down. 4 million people have been died. What's happening as far as Christianity in the Congo today, Peter?
Well, Dr. Stan, the exciting thing is bad times are good for spiritual work in that, amazingly, incredibly, there still is strong faith, there's strong churches. I was astounded. When I went to the Congo, I didn't expect to see much. I didn't think much of the church could have survived what's gone on there in the last few years. And yet we have found big, strong, well-organized, dedicated churches, uncompromising gospel preaching. So although the governments there are wicked and communist and corrupt, and the infrastructure is destroyed, yet you can see that the seed of the martyrs, and remember, hundreds of missionaries were murdered there in the early 60s, as you'll well remember. And yet, extraordinarily, I found massive churches that have stayed faithful to the Lord, and so we can praise God that even though they've been betrayed by the West, God has not forsaken the people.
In fact, one of Peter's missionaries, Charles, is Van Vyck, is that how you pronounce it?
Charles Van Vyck, yes.
Yes,
the hero of the St. James attack.
And of course, we've had him on the program in the past, and he's working at the Congo now, trying to bring people into a personal relationship with the Lord. And out of this chaos, you have to understand that there's no way, of course, you're going to get people to act responsibly unless, of course, they're answerable to God. And they believe in that adage, you know, fear God and keep his commandments, because that, of course, is what's so vitally important today. And if people fear God, we would not have the problems we have. Well, we'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program with Peter Hammond of Frontline Fellowship. Peter, you've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
Excellent. Thank you.
Go right ahead. You've got 3 minutes more.
Oh, wow. Dr. Yeah. Stan, I see that what's going on in Africa at the moment is a world war of worldviews. It's a battle for the soul of the continent. We see animism, a witchcraft, in the center, communism in the south, and Islam in the north. All three of these anti-Christian religions persecuting church, and so you see this battle for Africa. The Muslims in the north under Gaddafi are wanting to turn Africa into an Islamic continent with one language, Arabic, one religion, Islam. We see the communists, especially in the south, such as in Zimbabwe and the ANC in South Africa, wanting to turn Africa red. And then the witchcraft as the old voodooism, the animism of the continent. And these are the three main enemies that Christianity is fighting in Africa. Most of the violence that you hear, most of what you hear about violence in Nigeria or Congo or Zimbabwe, it's actually persecution of the church. That's the story that pulls everything together in Africa. It's anti-Christian. What happened in Rwanda was not tribalism as much as anti-Christian persecution. Most of the people killed in Rwanda were killed in churches and hospitals and schools. And I've waded knee-deep in corpses in Rwanda. There's no doubt in my mind that what we're seeing in Africa is spiritual war. It's a battle for the soul of the continent. And let's not give up on the people of Africa, even though we can see the governments of Africa are wicked. I remember the words of our dear friend Ian Smith, who went to be with the Lord at the end of last year. Ian Smith, the courageous Prime Minister of Rhodesia, who stood firm against the communist attacks on Rhodesia, he said, "We were never beaten by our enemies. We were betrayed by our friends." And I think that can be said by many Christians in Africa, from Jonas Savimbi of UNITA in Angola, through South Africa, Rhodesia. Many, many, many can say, Moise Tshombe of Katanga could all say, they would rise up from the grave and say in one chorus, "We were never beaten by enemies, we were betrayed by our friends." And it's a sad thing for me to have to report to my friends in America that I'm afraid the governments of the West, especially the State Department and the UN and the British Foreign Office, the Commonwealth, they have betrayed the friends, the Christians in Africa. Africa was a paradise in the 50s, and it's been turned into a hellhole now by not only turning out these countries into the hands of communist tyrants, but bailing out these tyrants and backing them up with aid. We need to defund the United Nations, and we need to stop sending aid to the mass murdering tyrants who are oppressing our people. We can survive and we can free ourselves from our tyrants if the West stops supporting these dictatorships throughout Africa. So our pledge is continue to pray for us, and I think of the words of the Lord Jesus in Luke 18, where he said, "We should always pray and not give up. Even an unjust judge will do what is right. We give persistent prayer and pressure."
Amen. Well, of course, Peter makes the point that, of course, the people of Africa were never defeated by the enemy. They were betrayed by their friends. Peter, God bless you. We'll talk to you Tuesday. I guess we'll talk to you Monday morning, and thank you so very much for everything you do.
Thank you, Dr. Stan. God bless.
And you too. Bye-bye. That's Chris. That certainly is Peter Hammond, certainly one of our favorite guests, Frontline Fellowship, and we recommend their ministry to you very, very strongly. We actually have a four-tape set called The Other Holocaust, which deals at least in part with the tragedy of what happened in Rwanda and how the United Nations, the leaders of the United Nations, insisted that the UN forces that were there not intervene to save the Christians, as 800,000 of them were simply hacked to death and then devoured by the dogs in the area. In fact, this is one of the things that everybody talked about, that there really weren't any dogs after the slaughter there, because they had to kill the dogs because they'd eaten so many human bodies, they no longer had respect for human beings. What a terrible, terrible tragedy. Largely, of course, ignored by the United States. In fact, Bill Clinton at the time ordered his State Department, nobody was to mention that there was genocide taking place in Rwanda, because then we would have to intervene. I've got the clippings from the New York Times where that was said, and but of course the average American never understood that we intentionally allowed those Christians to be slaughtered there, just as we intentionally allowed the Christians to be slaughtered in southern Sudan and in the Congo and of course in Angola, where of course the Christians were actually being slaughtered by the communists there, who were financed by Chevron Oil Company in Angola. Chevron was the one who financed Fidel Castro's troops that went over there. But the average individual can't understand these things. That's why you need to get the truth. Let me suggest our four-tape set, The Other Holocaust. And then, of course, we hope that you'll want to get Servando Gonzalez's excellent DVD entitled Terror in America. The Council on Foreign Relations. And you must understand that it's the people in the Council on Foreign Relations who are responsible for so many of the terrible things that are going on in America's foreign policy, which consistently favors communism over freedom. And that's why we brought the communists to power in Zimbabwe, Rhodesia. Why, we brought the communists to power in South Africa and Southwest Africa and Angola and in so many other places in the world. Recently, we brought the communists to power in Nepal, but the average American can't see that. So you need to get my talk. It's a DVD called World Revolution, where you'll actually see my interview with Ambassador Smith, who was the American ambassador to Cuba at the time, that the Central Intelligence Agency and the American State Department brought Fidel Castro to power, knowing full well that he was a communist. That's a very, very important talk, World Revolution. It's available on video. It's available on DVD. You need to get the information. You need to help us get this information out across America. And, of course, we hope many of you will want to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, that you'll want to get my talk on the forbidden secret and the syllabus that goes with that, my talk on the planned police state and the syllabus goes with that, because there we reproduce some of the writings, publications of the Luciferian organizations that are working in the United States today to influence our foreign and domestic policies. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, there really are Luciferian organizations. They have websites. You can go to them, thelucistrust.org. They know exactly what they're doing. They just don't want you to know what they're doing. But, of course, you can get their information. You can find out who finances them. Some of the richest and most powerful people in America today. So let's understand, ladies and gentlemen, we're involved in the spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. Peter Hammett is on the front lines of this battle, and I hope that you'll pray for him and for the success of his ministry and for his protection and his family's protection as they live in South Africa, a country which is going into chaos, just as the United States is going into chaos in the not-too-distant future, as our economic system begins to crumble, as our law enforcement begins to crumble, as our people turn further and further away from God. And please, ladies and gentlemen, pray for America. Pray for revival, because that's our only hope. Pray for our leaders. Pray that our ministers will have the courage to speak out. But please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that will determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and well, this next hour they're going to be the views of William Greig. And William was for many years the senior editor of the New American Magazine, and fortunately now we have him available to us, coming to us and doing programs with us a couple of times a week. He also, of course, writes extensively. He's written a book called Liberty in Eclipse. That's Liberty in Eclipse, and we do carry that book. You'll want to get that and read it through. He writes a blog, and we'll tell you later how you can get onto his blog site. And I will tell you that some of the better ministries are actually pulling down William's writings because, well, they're vivid, they're very, very accurate, and, of course, he is one of the most really successful writers that we have, a writer whose material has so much of an impact upon the people who read it. So without further ado, William Grieg, thank you very much for being with us again.
Dr. Stan, I really appreciate those generous words, and it's great to be with you this evening.
Go right ahead now, and speak up just a little louder, please.
Yeah, I was saying I really appreciate your generous comments this evening, and it's always a blessing to be with you. And I do think that we have to confront a number of really unfortunate things about the circumstances we live in today. There's no mystery, of course, that the economy is collapsing. And now that we're approaching the Memorial Day holiday and we can see the stratospherically high prices that we're going to have to pay for gasoline, and you can extrapolate from that the impact that those prices will have on everything that we have to buy that is shipped over land. And this is just the beginning of summer. I think people can understand the magnitude or get some inkling of the magnitude of the crisis we're confronting in the economic realm. But you have to couple that with the fact that in a realm where the impact is not yet fully felt, the government that rules us has made some fundamental changes that are going to have, that right now have very ominous implications for the way we're going to be living very shortly, and already you've started to have a physical impact on people, albeit in a peripheral way. And I think that a very good place to begin on this topic is to talk about some of the revelations that came out just this week about the proverbial little lists that the government has been keeping of American citizens who, in a time of crisis, would be considered, for lack of a better expression, enemy combatants. There's a very revealing story that came out. It was written by a contributor to Harper's Magazine. It was published in Radar, which is a relatively new publication. And the article, which is entitled The Last Roundup, talks about a database that the government is keeping that would be used for the purpose of determining who could be taken into custody in the event of a national emergency of some sort, be it a terrorist attack or perhaps a natural disaster or a series of violent, unpleasant shocks to the economy that would result in widespread tumult and social turmoil. And this list is called the Main Core. The Main Core, according to this article, is a list of some 8 million Americans, at least 8 million Americans, and based on what is known of the previous lists that have been compiled by agencies such as the FBI and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, the piece in Radar speculates that this Main Core database, and I'm quoting that from the article, includes dissidents and activists of various types, political and tax protesters, lawyers and professors, publishers and journalists, gun owners, illegal aliens, foreign nationals, and a great many other harmless average people.
And I think really what's so important, of course, this is all being done in the name of fighting terrorism.
Yes.
And the war on terrorism was never really designed to protect us from the Islamic jihadists. It was always a design, of course, to monitor and control and prepare for the arrest of American citizens. Go right ahead.
The really ironic thing about what we're seeing unfold before us right now is that a lot of the groundwork had been laid decades ago. At the beginning of what some people call the national security state after World War II, there were a number of elements. Of course, a lot of them are tied directly back to our really good friends in the Rockefeller dynasty and the outworking of that empire through tax-exempt foundations, the connections with British intelligence that brought about the creation of the OSS, which morphed into the CIA after World War II. A lot of these elements sought to make permanent some of the arrangements that were supposedly temporary during World War II. We've never had, prior to World War II and the immediate aftermath of that war, we'd never had a system, an established and permanent intelligence agency like the CIA. The CIA really hasn't been involved in intelligence so much as it's been involved in suborning revolutions abroad and working to bring about revolutionary changes in various governments and precipitating crises that are used as rationales for intervention, whether you're talking about the disruption of the Iranian government and the Guatemalan government in the 1950s, or various other things that have been undertaken where putatively anti-communist governments were installed, were actually, in literal fact, pro-communist governments. That, of course, creates a crisis. The solution is an expansion of the federal government's role as an interventionist power in the world and a concomitant increase in the amount of power the government has to exercise domestically. But what has happened since about 1946, when the national security state was created, was that there was always this latent power to regulate, to surveil the American people, and to collate this information into these huge lists of information and computer databases that would be used for the purpose of eventually determining, in the context of a national emergency, who would be taken into detention. One of the earliest proposals of that sort, and this is something you and I have mentioned before, but it bears further examination, was a proposal made by J. Edgar Hoover at the FBI, and actually the proposal was made as early as 1946, and he was given permission in 1948 to begin creating his little security index. And after the outbreak of the Korean War in 1950, which was an event largely precipitated by the collaboration of the Truman administration with the Soviet Union in bringing about this crisis, Mr. Hoover made a proposal to Sidney W. Sowers, who was a special assistant for national security to President Truman, that they use the security index to round up people who were considered to be seditious, disloyal, or suspect. Sidney Sowers, by the way, was the first director of the entity that became known as the CIA in 1950 when this proposal was made by J. Edgar Hoover.
Hold that thought for just a moment. And, of course, William is telling us about the fact that at the beginning of the Korean War, J. Edgar Hoover suggested that they had a list of all the subversives in America. And as we were moving into the Korean War, he wanted to round all of these people up, and he wanted to put them in concentration camps, and had suggested this to one of the assistants to President Truman, and picked up the story from there,
yep.
William.
The assistant was Sidney W. Sowers, who had been the first director of Central Intelligence, albeit in a very transitory role. But what had happened is that through various means, J. Edgar Hoover, who was not an altogether bad figure in our history, a very ambivalent figure. He's somebody who professionalized an agency, the FBI, back before it was called the FBI, that had become very notorious for corruption and inefficiency. And he had done some good things early in his career, but for whatever reason, he was a compulsive keeper of lists, and he was somebody who approved of government secrecy. And as the following anecdote will relate, he's somebody who really didn't have all that much by way of established, principled opposition to the wide-scale or wholesale detention of American citizens. But he made the proposal in 1946, it was approved in 1948, and in 1950 it was made a matter of formal policy, that these 12,000 people who are on these lists of potential subversives be rounded up. And what he wrote in this message to Sidney Sowers was the following: the index now contains approximately 12,000 individuals, of which approximately 97% are citizens of the United States. And then he went on to say that the solution for dealing with these troublemakers would be the following: a master warrant to be attached to a list naming those subject to arrest, coupled with the presidential declaration suspending the habeas corpus guarantee as applied to these people. And then the FBI, working in tandem with the military, would make arrangements to round these people up and to detain them in a number of military facilities across the nation. I'm intrigued by a couple of ideas here, the first of which is, of course, the suspension of habeas corpus as it deals with these 12,000 people, 97% of whom were American citizens. The habeas corpus guarantee is the fundamental due process guarantee. It's of great antiquity. It goes back at least to 1215. It's part of our Anglo-Saxon heritage of due process and individual liberty. And if you suspend the writ of habeas corpus, as Congress is permitted to do under the Constitution, that, by the way, is one of two or three major defects in the Constitution that I would change if I were in charge of revising the document, brilliant as it is, indispensable as it is, there are a couple of flaws that I would change, and that is one of them. But if you suspend the writ of habeas corpus, what you're doing is you're permitting the government to detain people indefinitely without legal recourse. And this is something being discussed in 1950 by J. Edgar Hoover as it applies to these American citizens. Now, in 2008, that's a matter of settled policy by way of the Military Commissions Act of October 2006, which provides for the suspension on a case-by-case basis of habeas corpus for those who are defined by presidential decree as unlawful enemy combatants, be they foreigners or American citizens. And in principle, if you can rupture the habeas corpus guarantee as it applies to anybody, none of us has the protection of the writ of habeas corpus. And it just amazes me that J. Edgar Hoover was making this proposal in writing in 1950, and now, 58 years later, we're seeing how the seeds that he sowed are beginning to blossom in their full malevolence. The second thing about his proposal that I find really provocative is the idea of a master warrant. Now, you don't have, in the American tradition and in the Anglo-Saxon tradition that is the antecedent to our constitutional heritage, you don't have this concept of a master warrant. It's more like a bill of attainder is what he's describing here. An arrest warrant or a search warrant has to be specific. Particularly when we're talking about a search warrant, it has to name specifically the place to be searched, the thing that that the police are looking for, the person for whom the police are looking. Same thing applies with respect to an arrest warrant. And here, J. Edgar Hoover is talking about having some kind of an open-ended master warrant that would be used to justify the summary detention of over 12,000 people. And that was a little list being made starting in 1946 and through 1950. Now, there's no record, of course, of this mass roundup being undertaken in 1950. But if you take a look at how this proposal sort of attached itself and then integrated itself into the warp and weave of federal policy, a really scary story is told. About the same time that Hoover was making this proposal, the federal government undertook to build an emergency continuity of government facility in Mount Weather, which is in Virginia, in the beautiful part of the Blue Ridge Mountains, not the Blue Ridge Mountains, forgive me, but the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia. And this Mount Weather facility was on a tract of land obtained, I believe, in 1902 or 1903 by the federal government and used for various experiments having to do with meteorology, hence the name Mount Weather. And I think during the FDR administration, it was actually the site of a civilian conservation corps camp. And no particular use was being made of this area until the early 1950s when the Pentagon and other agencies yet to be adequately identified created this huge, sprawling underground complex that would be used for the purpose of providing for the physical security of the executive branch, top echelon executive branch officials, and selected people from various civilian realms in the event of a nuclear exchange or some other large-scale catastrophe. And not whether it was a secretive installation that was built with off-the-budget or disguised funds, but by the early 1960s, there were already references being made in popular literature to this secret facility. There was a novel that came out in 1962 that you probably remember, Dr. Stan, called 7 Days in May, that was turned into a movie in 1964 that talked about the idea of a military coup within the United States to overthrow a presidential administration and install martial law. And that novel and movie both talked about the secretive facility, not by name, but people who were in the know knew that they were referring to Mount Weather. In 1975, there was a California senator by the name of John Tunney, who was the son of the famous boxer, incidentally, who did a very detailed investigation of surveillance programs that were being used to monitor the American public. And he made reference in his final report to the fact that this Mount Weather facility appeared to be the central location of a number of facilities that have been set up across the country for the purposes of continuity of government operations. And it appeared to be the central node of an information system that was gathering and collating immense volumes of data about common American citizens. The following year, there was an article in this left-wing journal called The Progressive, which, despite its ideological bent, does some pretty good investigative work. And they also made reference to the fact that at Mount Weather, at the Mount Weather installation, there was this huge computer database that was being used to keep track of various American citizens from various walks of life. And by 1991, Mount Weather was an open secret. Time magazine did a cover story that I remember very well about its creation, its origins, and its purpose, that I consider to be sort of a controlled release type of an article. Time magazine has always been very close to the CIA. As a matter of fact, both Time and Newsweek, Newsweek being a publication of the Washington Post Group. They're both very establishmentarian, establishment-oriented publications. Time tends to be closer to the CIA. The Washington Post Group, of course, is more or less the house organ for public consumption of the Council on Foreign Relations, although Foreign Affairs is their official journal. The Washington Post and Newsweek give us a pretty good sense of what that organization's take on events would be and what the official line that we are supposed to we're supposed to absorb is. But 1991, Time had this big publication about the Mount Weather facility. And then, strangely enough, there was a film that came out in 2002 called The Sum of All Fears, which was an adaptation of a pretty good novel by Tom Clancy. And there were a couple of things in the film that were interesting disclosures. And right at the beginning of the film, much to my astonishment when I went to see it in 2002 on its debut weekend, there was a scene shot at the actual location of Mount Weather. So this is something that they're not even bothering to hide now in terms of its existence. But they're not really being candid about the fact that inside this facility, this underground bunker that would house various luminaries, both government and corporate, there is this huge computer database, which is operated by FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, that contains huge volumes of data on an unspecified number of American citizens. Back in 1975, 1976, which was sort of the Paleolithic era of computer technology, according to the Progressive magazine, the computer system that FEMA had at Mount Weather could, and I quote now, obtain millions of pieces of information on the personal lives of American citizens by tapping the data stored at any of the 96 federal relocation centers. That's a really interesting disclosure that was made over 30 years ago, that there was this network, this archipelago, if you want to use the Russian term, of relocation centers scattered across the United States. They're all feeding information into the central node at Mount Weather. And, of course, the next big disclosure that happened after that 1975-1976 disclosure happened in 1987 during the Iran-Contra hearings, when Oliver North was very famously asked by Congressman Jack Brooks of Texas about the Rex 84 program. Congressman Brooks didn't use the expression Rex 84, but he was talking about this program that envisioned circumstance in which, in the context of a national emergency, the Constitution would be suspended, formally suspended, and you'd have the appointment of regional military proconsuls to administer regions of the country. They would be running state and local governments, and you'd have a comprehensive roundup of people considered to be undesirable, whether they're criminal suspects or non-criminal troublemakers.
I'm going to have to interrupt you there for just a minute, but I would comment for our listeners that we actually have the film footage of what William Craig is talking about, when, of course, Congressman Jack Brooks tries to bring out the fact that there is this plan, in case of a national emergency, to suspend the Constitution and rout of American citizens, and, of course, a senator, in a way, would not allow it. That's called the Amazing Clips. Available from Radio Liberty. Go right ahead.
Yeah, one of the things I find sort of ironic about that little exchange is that it was Congressman Jack Brooks who brought this up. Mr. Brooks was not somebody who is noted as being bold or principled. Not many people in Congress are. I remember vividly that in 1993, following the attack on the Branch Davidian community at Mount Carmel outside of Waco, Texas, after that community had been annihilated in the final federal assault on April 19th, Jack Brooks, who represented that district in Congress, was caught on tape at a meeting, I believe, of his constituents, in a meeting with his constituents in Texas, saying, and I quote, "Those people got what they deserved." Now, if you take a look at how the Branch Davidian tragedy came about, you have in microcosm a pretty good example of how the system that Brooks was trying to ask Oliver North about would function. You have a group of people who are isolated, socially alienated or marginalized. They were, of course, demonized in the press as being intolerably weird. The leader of their community was described as a charismatic cult leader. David Koresh is a rather enigmatic man, but one of the things that we know about the guy is that had he been guilty of or reasonably suspected of criminal offenses, and a lot were imputed to him from illegal firearms sales and illegal firearms modifications to various types of sexual misbehavior with young women that would be against state and local laws. If he had been plausibly suspected of any of these things, it was a matter of the purest simplicity to pick him up when he went jogging or to arrest him when he was downtown. He'd frequently go downtown to Waco to jam at a local bar. He was an accomplished rock musician. And rather than doing any of these things, rather than simply cooperating when he invited the ATF to go out to the ranch where he maintained a gun shop and look at his facilities, look at his inventory, the federal government arranged for this high-profile raid by the ATF that ended up with the death, needless death, of four ATF agents and a number of people from that community. And then after this happened, you had this 51-day standoff where the federal government of the United States collaborated with, among other interesting folks, elements of the Soviet KGB, including a fellow by the name of Igor Smirnov of the Moscow Institute for Psychocorrection. They put together a campaign of psychological torture and manipulation trying to break down the resistance of the Davidians before day 51, when the FBI, in collaboration with people from various elements of the special operations community of our government, conducted a full-force raid that involved the use of chemical weapons that were banned for battlefield use by international convention, and the use of military personnel illegally in a trigger-pulling capacity to herd these people into this burning building or summarily to shoot them outside. But this was all done in a way that involved the physical detention of people and the use of high technology and highly sophisticated psychological operations in an attempt to eliminate this community outright. And then Jack Brooks, the guy who'd been asking about Brecht 84 in 1987, just 6 years earlier, spoke with utterly pitiless contempt about these American citizens and innocent foreign nationals who were murdered by our government in such a conspicuous fashion. But like I said, it's ironic that he was the one who was trying to ask Oliver North about this, about the fact that there was this existing plan and this infrastructure that had been set up to keep lists and databases and dossiers that would be used to cull out of the general population in the event of a national emergency those elements of the population that would be considered to be excessively troublesome, and to incarcerate them at various points of the country.
There. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Arthur Stan, and William Grigg is simply talking about what happened when that was during the Rand-Contra hearings, when Congressman Jack Brooks was trying to bring out the truth, bring out the fact that there was a plan, in case of a national emergency, to suspend the Constitution and the right of habeas corpus, and, of course, to round up American citizens and put them in concentration camps. And as Jack Brooks actually raises the point, Senator Inouye keeps interrupting and says, you can't bring that up. We can't talk about that here. We can talk about it in private session, in closed session. We cannot talk about it here. And what Senator Inouye was really saying is, we can't let the American people know the truth of what we have planned for them. Now, if that sounds absurd to you, actually, we have the film footage of that interchange, and of course, it's called The Amazing Clips. And of course, we even have it in another form, just as an 8-minute, 10-minute clip with a number of other important clips. But The Amazing Clips is available in our concentration camp, special or by itself. You need to get this information. You need to understand that what is taking place has long-term planning. And of course, Congressman Jack Brooks tried to bring this out in 1988. Totally suppressed by the American press. Go ahead with that story, William.
Well, the other element of the story that I find really interesting is the involvement of Oliver North in this enterprise. And this enterprise, of course, is what he called a standalone, off-the-shelf, parallel or alternate government that was operating to funnel arms to the Iranian government at a time when Iran was fighting against another subcontractor of Washington, Iraq, and use the proceeds from this arms sale to fund the Nicaraguan Contras. In essence,
we were providing weapons for the Iranians, we were providing weapons for the Iraqis, we were providing weapons for both sides. And what the average American doesn't understand is we have always done that in all of our conflicts, whether it be what happened during the Second World War with Adolf Hitler. His military was built up by American corporations, and even during the course of the Second World War, American corporations, specifically Exxon, were trading with the enemy. Mm-hmm. But of course, the American people couldn't be allowed to realize that General Motors and Ford Motor Company had built the weapons and the tanks, and of course AT&T had built the Stuka dive bomber that were being used to kill American soldiers.
Yeah, and you had many of these information technologies surrounding AT&T who were helping to carry out the collation of data on those who were fed into the concentration camps that the Nazis were running. The other thing I find interesting, of course, is that beginning in 1933, you had a similar combine of American corporations who were building up the Soviet Union, getting taxpayer subsidies to the Export-Import Bank, which was set up for the express purpose of building up the Soviet Union's infrastructure and financial base. And you had the Lend-Lease program, which was being used to build up the Soviet Union, including, according to Major Racy Jordan's diaries, providing the Soviet Union with the essentials of building the hydrogen bomb. So this is very much an enterprise that the government of the United States has been involved in for many, many decades. And one element that we saw in the 1980s with the so-called Iran-Contra scandal was this subterranean world of arms dealing with federal taxpayer dollars, where you were arming both sides of the Iran-Iraq war. Washington had goaded Iraq into attacking Iran after bringing Khomeini to power in Iran, and then the Reagan administration in Washington, first in 1983, sent Donald Rumsfeld, who, by the way, in spite of the fact that he was a civilian at the time, was somebody who was on the list to be brought into the Mount Weather facility in the event of a nuclear war. He and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney both were on the list to be brought into the undisclosed location there and protected, in spite of the fact that Dick Cheney at the time was a congressman. It's really interesting how they have the same little group of players who are in the part of that privileged realm. But Donald Rumsfeld was dispatched to Baghdad in 1983 in order to shake hands with Saddam Hussein and open up the avenues of financial and military support during the war with Iran. And a couple of years later, you had the enterprise headed by Oliver North conducting similar types of diplomacy with Tehran to provide them with weapons to fight Iraq, while at the same time diverting some of the funds to use for the propagation of insurrectionary war in Nicaragua against the Nicaraguan Sandinista regime, which had been brought to power by Washington in 1978 and 1979.
These were consistent.
A motion machine.
Go right ahead.
But the thing about all of these enterprises, they all center on the same lot of people, and Oliver North, of course, was sort of the puckish face of this enterprise, and he's now, of course, a certified celebrity in conservative circles. He's seen as something, I guess, of a Norman Rockwellian type of a character, but it's a little bit more diabolical than that when you understand that he's the front man for this cabal that includes many of the people who are the architects of the homeland security state we're living under right now. People like John Negroponte, who was the first director of national intelligence in the Bush administration. John Negroponte was somebody who was deeply involved with the CIA and the shenanigans in Central America in the 1980s.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is William Grigg, and so go ahead and pick the story up. You were talking about, of course, John Negroponte.
Yeah, John Negroponte was heavily involved in every element of the ugliness that surrounds the relationship between Washington and Iraq, starting in about 1979. And he was also involved very deeply in what was going on in El Salvador and Honduras, and other countries in Latin America. I believe at one point he was the ambassador to Honduras, or a highly placed diplomatic personage in Honduras. And he's been very plausibly connected to covert activities by the CIA in the region that helped to sow misery and turmoil and violence in the region. And he was somebody who's very close to Henry Kissinger during the Vietnam War. And he was the personage, the elevated, exalted personage selected to be the first director of national intelligence when the newly expanded and greatly enhanced intelligence agency was introduced a couple of years ago. The CIA has been folded into this huge, sprawling mess of an intelligence entity. And Mr. Negroponte was put in charge of it. And so he's one of these people who is the architect of a lot of the real ugly things that our government have been getting involved in overseas, these covert channels whereby wars and revolutions are incited. And then the profits that are generated from arms deals are used to generate more tumult and chaos. And all of these things, of course, are used in the domestic realm as justification for enhancing the powers of surveillance and regimentation here at home. And Oliver North, you know, 22, 23 years ago, was somebody who was presiding over the creation of this plan, Rex 84, which envisioned the use of these databases to extract from the general population those people who would be considered to be indigestible in the event of a national emergency, and thus would be sent to any one of at least 10 or 12 military detention facilities here in the United States. The reason why I dwell so long on so many of these elements is that they sync up so perfectly with what's going on right now as we see these disclosures about the way that warrantless surveillance and cyber surveillance and the fusion centers which have been created to collate information between the federal government and state and local police agencies, there are at least 42 of them in operation right now. These fusion centers are completely unconstitutional. There is not supposed to be the commingling of information in that fashion and the commingling of efforts between the federal, state, and local law enforcement agencies. The state and local law enforcement agencies are supposed to be independent of
Washington. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Chris William Grigg was talking about how, of course, in violation of our own laws, there seems to be an organized effort to commingle information from the various government and state agencies. What they've done is they put together an enemies list of about 8 million people who will have to be rounded up and put into detention camps when, of course, the next major crisis comes. People say it couldn't happen here in America. Ladies and gentlemen, not only could happen, it has happened in the past, where they simply routed up American citizens in 1942 and sent them off to concentration camps, mainly because they were Japanese. And, of course, some of them were Italian and some of them were Germans, all loyal American citizens, no right of habeas corpus. But in an emergency, oh, my goodness, we have to hate the Japs. We have to hate those wicked Japs, even if they're American citizens,
yeah.
And how effective that was. But before we go on, William, I want you to tell our listeners how they can get to your blog site and get your information.
Okay, I appreciate that. There are two ways to get to my blog site. My blog is entitled Pro Libertate. That's a Latin phrase that means for freedom. I write compulsively about freedom-related subjects. I'm a compulsive, obsessive writer when it comes to matters of freedom. And the easiest way, the quickest way, is either to go to Google and type in Pro Libertate, and then my last name, Grigg, and that would take your listener right to the blog. The web address for my blog is freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Once again, freedom in our time, that's one word, freedominourtime.blogspot.com. Or you can go to the homepage of the Welsh Foundation, for which I serve as the editor-at-large, and the homepage is called Right Source Online. The Right Source is the official name of the page. The web address is rightsourceonline.com. Once again, that's one word, rightsourceonline.com. If you go to the Right Source, at the top of the page, there's a banner ad for my book, Liberty in Eclipse, which is also carried by Radio Liberty. And if you look at the left-hand side of the screen, and you scroll down about a third of the way down the page, you'll find my photograph. And there'll be a hyperlink next to my photograph that'll take you to my blog, Pro Libertate. I try to update it between 3 and 5 times a week as my situation makes it possible to do so. And the reason why I update it with such austerity is the fact that, unlike other blogs, I'm trying to publish full-length, feature-length articles that are documented with hyperlinks and other information. And this takes a little bit more effort than simply writing ephemeral little paragraphs about the passing scene. I don't disparage that. I think there's a very useful function that is served by many, many blogs and writers who maintain blogs who simply use those outlets as a way of updating the public on various stories. They're doing wonderful work, and I'm really grateful to them because they help me tremendously. But what I try to do is to write an essay typically between 1,200 and 2,000 words that in some way advances a story beyond merely reviewing what is available in the media. And that requires a little bit more effort, particularly given the fact that I work out of my home here and I'm responsible for taking care of a very large family. We have five small children, and that's a very time-intensive undertaking, and it's easily the best thing anybody can do with his or her time is to supervise the upbringing of little kids. There's just nothing better than children. But like I say, because of the vagaries of my schedule, every once in a while it'll take a little longer to write something that I like, which is why 3 to 5 times a week at least I try to put something new on my blog, Pro Libertate.
All right, fine. Well, you, Chris, you were talking about this whole idea that they are really compiling these lists. Now, people have to understand that this would never have been allowed in America, except that they were able to convince us, oh, we're involved in a war on terrorism. The terrorists want to come and kill us. The Muslims hate us. The jihadists hate us. Ladies and gentlemen, the jihadists, this whole world jihadist movement is, of course, financed by the Saudi Arabians, who are good friends of the Bush family. If there was really a terrorist threat, we would long ago closed our southern borders. If there was really a threat from terrorism, why, we would have air marshals on every plane instead of on perhaps 5 or 10% of our planes. If there was really a threat from terrorism, they would have insisted that every pilot be armed to protect the passengers on the plane. If there was really a threat from terrorism, we would have had other major attacks in the United States by terrorists, other than those that have been contrived by the Federal Bureau of Investigation by agent provocateurs who wanted to blow up the Sears Tower or other FBI plans. So basically it is a fraud, but of course it's very effective because a lot of Americans say, gee, we've got to give the government more power over our lives to protect us from the wicked Osama bin Laden, who's over there in a cave in Pakistan planning on taking away our freedom. So go ahead with
that's a very important part of it. The other part of the psychology, which is the obverse of what you're describing, is that there's a greater acceptance of the idea that there need to be permanent institutionalized structures that dispense special justice against those or upon those who are considered to be terrorists or enemy combatants, and how you can create this parallel universe of militarized justice, summary justice, of what used to be called the barrelhead courts or barrelhead tribunal variety, that we can create these structures that have nothing to do with the common daily workings of our justice system, as if they could be hermetically sealed from each other. And that's why people, of course, insist that we have to maintain this facility at Guantanamo Bay that is, by any definition, a gulag. That's where the worst of the worst must be kept. That's why we have to institutionalize the use of torture, why the CIA should retain the power of extraordinary rendition to take people to various foreign countries that practice torture and subcontract the torture of these prisoners to people such as the Syrians, for instance. And why we have to have the president invested with the power of declaring certain people enemy combatants who are outside the protection of the law and subject to trial by military commission and such like. The thing is, all of those elements sync up perfectly with the system we've been describing of culling people out from the general population in the event of a national emergency and putting them into military detention. If there is a national emergency, another terrorist attack of a magnitude comparable to 9/11, for instance, wholesale collapse of the economy, some series of natural disasters that seriously disrupt the economy, inter-ethnic warfare that breaks out within the United States, which is something I can see certain people diligently cultivating in our country, any of these scenarios could lead to a situation where these plans, these contingency plans that have been put together over the course of decades, would be activated, and common Americans, American citizens born, bred, and raised in the United States, died in the wool, natural-born citizens of the United States could find themselves on the receiving end of exactly the type of supposed justice that is being used now in the context of the war on terror, because they would be under military jurisdiction rather than having access to congressmen and governors and mayors and other officials. They would be under the jurisdiction of a military proconsul who would be assigned to the region of the country, rather than expecting the full panoply of rights and due process protections that we expect when we are brought before a civilian court. These people would find themselves, in the event that they are arraigned for an accused crime, on the receiving end of military justice. That's something that would be carried out in this country. And those who are considered to be particularly troublesome would already be subject to heightened scrutiny and perhaps even summary detention under this system. This is something which has been, once again, put together over the course of many, many decades, and now is coming to fruition under the Bush administration, when we read about this main core database where we have at least 8 million people already identified as troublesome, not as potential terrorists, mind you, but as simply people who, for whatever reason, would be of particular interest in the event that we have a national emergency. And so when we see the government proclaiming the power to arrest and detain and interrogate without formal criminal charges somebody like Jose Padilla for a number of years, when his rights of habeas corpus are denied to him and he's subject to severe torture, including, according to a legal document filed by his attorneys, the administration, forcible administration of psychotropic drugs, and when he finds himself effectively destroyed as a personality because he'd been decreed an enemy combatant by the president, you're looking at something that is entirely plausible as an outcome for anybody who'd find himself sucked into the system we're describing. I need to point out as well, it's ironic that this all begins in a way with J. Edgar Hoover, because J. Edgar Hoover had actually objected to the mass roundup of Japanese citizens in 1942. The FBI had been investigating the existence of alleged rings of saboteurs and partisans of the Japanese government within the American-Japanese community, and J. Edgar Hoover provided to the relevant congressional committees and to the FDR administration information on what he considered to be some plausible threats in the event of a war with Japan. But when the policy was announced to relocate the American citizens' Japanese ancestry inland from the coast and put them into camps such as Manzanar, J. Edgar Hoover actually objected to that, as did a number of other people you wouldn't necessarily have expected, because you'd be surprised that they had delicate sensibilities about civil liberties. But J. Edgar Hoover, to his eternal credit, did object to that program. Nonetheless, 8 years later, here he is. Actually, it was even sooner than that. 4 years later, here he is using that precedent to build this more elaborate plan for detention, mass detention of American citizens.
And isn't it interesting that they use these terms, you know, relocation camps? No, the concentration camps, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah.
The concentration camps for the Japs, for the Japanese American citizens, most of them loyal citizens, and of course they're going to be concentration camps for you and your family out there, because they know what you're listening to. They have means of tracking what you do with your internet. I mean, who you support, what you think. They have a system of informants all across America. I know, because at one time I was recruited to become an informant for some sort of a government agency. They're watching you. If you've never seen your own dossier, I have my dossier. At least I got many years ago from the FBI. You know, dozens of pages blacked out in the name of national security.
That's what mine looked like, too.
So I think you have to understand, ladies and gentlemen, this is not imaginary. This is very real. And what William is talking about is a real threat. When are you going to take a stand and help people like William Craig and myself, as we're trying to sound the alarm across America that the wicked people are not coming, they're already here, and the enemy is not in Moscow, the enemy is not at a cave in Pakistan, the enemy is in Washington, D.C., and they wear nice suits and white shirts and black ties or colored ties, they look very much like you and I, but they have a different worldview, and they do want a dictatorship in America.
One of the things that I think people need to understand when they get a little bit antsy about the possibility of being on a list is that we're already there. If we've done anything worthwhile, chances are we've already ended up on a list of some sort. As a matter of fact, I've started ending my blog with the little rhetorical question, what have you done today to earn a place on the list? And the reason why I say that is because we really shouldn't worry about things that we cannot control, and this is one of those things we can't control. What we should worry about is doing the right thing for the right reasons. We should make ourselves conspicuous in such a way that we would earn membership on a list of that sort. Think of our founding fathers. Here were people, men, real men, who signed a document that put themselves outside of the protection of the law. If they had lost the war for independence, they would have been executed as traitors with the full menu of horrors that procedure entails. If you've seen the end of Braveheart, that's what these people faced. The men who signed the Declaration of Independence would have died the way that William Wallace died at the end of Braveheart, because they were going to be treated as petty traitors to the crown. And yet they signed that document knowing that they put themselves on a list. And John Hancock, when he signed the document, the first to inscribe his signature thereon, made sure that he made it big, bold, and conspicuous. He wrote his name in letters big enough that even Fat King George could read them, as he said, as he attached his pen to that document. And so, you know, that's the heritage that we ought to look to. I mean, we are, if not necessarily in physical terms, but certainly I would hope in spiritual terms, ideological terms, the offspring of the bold men who signed that document, knowing they were putting their names on a list that, of course, is now a list of honor, but at the time could have been very easily used as a death warrant. So do something to make yourself conspicuous to the people who are going to be compiling these lists, because if you don't, chances are you're already on that list, and that list will be used against you someday. You know, you've got nothing to lose if you do the right thing.
Amen to that, and I certainly agree with you. We're dealing with people of a Machiavellian outlook. They're people who really do support the concepts of Machiavelli, and of course this gets us into my next newsletter on the neoconservatives and their dedication to Machiavelli and Plato and Michael Ledeen and Leo Strauss. And now that's another subject. Ladies and gentlemen, we're dealing with wicked and evil people who have a plan. And that is to precipitate a crisis. What it'll be, I don't know. But to use that crisis to begin to round up American citizens. And if you think that you're going to be able, of course, to be silent and be safe, why, you're not going to be. Everyone and their family are in jeopardy today. Go ahead, William.
I agree with that. I mean, there are so many people who really believe that safety is to be found in obscurity. And I believe that to the extent that we can be safe, and we, by the way, shouldn't want to be safe, we should want to be free. And there are ways that being free involve risks. You know, just deal with it. That's the way that life has been arranged by our Creator. If you're going to be free, you're going to have to take some chances. One of the chances we're going to have to take is that by doing the right thing and making ourselves prominent by doing the right thing, we're going to earn the malevolent attentions of those who would compile lists of the sort we've been describing, that we would come to the attention of these people who look at us with cold, dead, alien eyes, to use G.K. Chesterton's deathless expression. But the thing is, becoming obscure is not going to make us any safer. And, of course, making ourselves prominent or conspicuous, you know, standing out from the crowd, holding ourselves above the common mass, that's not going to make us safer either. But what it will do is it'll make it more difficult for us to disappear. And if you're talking about an extreme set of circumstances, we're talking about the situation in extremis. You want to make yourself difficult to disappear. You know, people would ask questions if Stan Monteith were to disappear one day. And if you were a really visible presence in your neighborhood among your friends and family, speaking about freedom and working on behalf of freedom, there would be a hole that we would left if you simply disappeared. To the extent that we can have some kind of security, I think that's some pretty good security. But, of course, the only real security comes from getting right with God, the author of our liberties, and the ultimate guarantor of the same. And I believe that he wants us to be bold. I don't think that he wants us to be taking refuge in the catacombs today. I think he wants us to be out battling with every element of what he's given us to retain the freedoms that he gave us.
I agree with you totally. In fact, you know, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty.
Amen.
And, of course, a coward dies a thousand deaths. A brave man dies but once. And where do you want to stand, ladies and gentlemen? You're going to have to make that decision sooner or later. Are you going to stand up against the impending tyranny being imposed by what I refer to as the Brotherhood of Darkness that simply has put up a phony war on terrorism, a justification for implementing a police state? Go right ahead, William.
I think the Brotherhood of Darkness is the best way to describe the people we're talking about here. These people tend to thrive and pullulate in the dark. And one thing that they can't withstand, of course, is the bright light of principled scrutiny. And I've been in the presence of many of the people you're describing, Dr. Stan. I've seen their works in POMS, and I've been able to take their measure as individuals. Notice I don't call them men. I don't consider these people to be men. They're no stronger than we are. They're no smarter than we are. They're just a lot more ruthless than we are. They're a lot more immoral. There's great tactical flexibility that comes when you don't recognize your necessity to obey the laws of God and man. And that's the type of people we're dealing with here.
But of course, there are a lot more of us than there are of them.
Amen.
And if the American people would ever stand up and say, we're not going to put up with this, why, they would back down. They're frightened to get to death. And we're going to find out, the majority are going to find out, and hold them responsible. Well, yes. William, you have 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
You bring up a good point. We talked about the fact that there are more of us than there are of them. I mean, in the aggregate numbers, that's certainly true. We're talking in terms of the real hardcore elite here. We're talking about people who number in the thousands, if not in the hundreds. And through guile and deception and bribery and bluff, I think about 80% or 90% of what these people do is bluff. They've managed to leverage their influence in ways that we can't imagine. But they are terrified of us. Everything they do bespeaks the terror that they have of us. The fact that they've created this homeland security state, the tangible and obvious purpose of which is to protect them from us, should give us some idea of what they really fear. They fear the peaceful, principled, and resolute action, organized action, of individuals who are committed to the principles of liberty. That's what they fear the most. They don't fear the people who are their subcontractors. They don't fear the bin Ladens of the world. They don't fear Hamas or Hezbollah or the Islamic radical movement under whatever brand name. What they fear is the spirit of Americanism made vivid and tangible in the lives of millions and millions of people who've caught the spirit of liberty. And so I do think that if we find some way of motivating people to return to the first principles of our founding, to return to the first principles of our Christian heritage, and to act with bold and conspicuous resolution, we can really put those people back on their heels. Admittedly, that's when things will really get nasty, but at least in those circumstances we'll have a fighting chance.
I agree with you totally, and I think, of course, we have to realize, of course, it's a spiritual battle. We want to, of course, be on the Lord's side. We don't want the Lord on our side. We would like, of course, to believe he is, but I'm not egotistical enough to believe that the God is going to do what I want.
Exactly.
I just hope that I'm doing what he wants. And I believe each one of us is called in this truly spiritual battle to take a stand, because, of course, we don't stand up now. Why, of course, we will never be able to take a stand, and I'd rather die on my feet than live on my knees, because those, so often happens is that those, who cry appease are often killed by those they hope to please.
Exactly.
Anyway, William, I really appreciate everything you do, and I appreciate your writing, and I look forward to having you with us again next week.
Thanks so much. God bless.
And you too. Bye-bye. Good night. And this was William Gregg, and we're so really fortunate to have William come onto our program. He's one of the most articulate of the spokesmen we have in the conservative field, and I think we're really privileged to have he and Joel Skousen, a couple of the other regular people that we have on our programs here, bringing you the information you're not going to get elsewhere. The news behind the news, the story behind the story. We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up the program. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, this is the time when I need to remind all of our listeners that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and quite frankly, we need your help, because we went behind last month, and we don't want to keep doing that. We don't want to have to cut back on anything that we have. We picked up, 7 new stations. They're only half an hour a week, but some of these are major stations. One of them is a 50,000-watt station out of Tupelo, Mississippi, that's going to be carrying our program, and for the first time, people in that region are going to have an opportunity to hear the truth. And, of course, they're only going to hear it if God wants them to. Our job is to put the information out, and we don't want to have to cut back on any of the things that we have that are allowing us to bring people the truth, the real understanding of the spiritual nature of the battle in which we're engaged. Well, let me point out that we carry William Gregg's book, Liberty and Eclipse. Liberty and Eclipse. We really think it's an important book. And then we're carrying the Ron Paul Revolution. The Ron Paul Revolution. We hope that you want to get this compilation of Ron's ideas and thoughts. The Ron Paul Revolution, the book. We have a 4-tape set on concentration camps. We have a 4-tape set on the Military Commission Act, which, of course, is what allows for the dictatorship and goes right into the repealing of the Posse Comitatus Act, the legislation that has been put in place to establish a dictatorship in America. We have a 4-tape set on Sydney, we have a DVD entitled The Planned Police State, and it comes with a syllabus we think is very, very important. We actually have, of course, the film clip we talked about, the amazing clips, and you can get that by itself. or a four-tape set on concentration camps by itself, or the four-tape set, video America behind Bob Wire. And then, of course, you get the amazing clips and a lot of other information in the concentration camp special. And anything we have produced here at Radio Liberty, you have our permission to duplicate and get out to other people. So again, you can get the four tape set on concentration camps. You can get the DVD, America Behind Barbed Wire. You can get you get the concentration camp special, you get the DVD, America Behind Barbed Wire, you get the amazing clips, you get the document on use of civilian internees in the concentration camps, and that all comes with the concentration camp special, or you can get the things separately if you'd like. We do hope, of course, that you will take the time to get this material, to get it out, and remember my talk on the planned police state, and the syllabus goes with that, which is separate. But, of course, this is a compilation of everything that William Grieg was talking about tonight, all the documentation on it. It was almost as if he'd studied my syllabus, which I'm sure he has. He has his own sources of information. But we recommend this very strong to you. The DVD, the planned police state, the syllabus, the planned police state. And then, of course, we hope that you'll tell others about the things we talk about. Get them to listen to Radio Liberty. Take our newsletters and copy them and hand them out in front of grocery stores, in front of malls. Hand them out at a flea market. Hand them out to try to get people to understand.